Well, hello again. So now I can finally do my, can we all then guess the museum? We can't guess the object yet, but I know everyone can from last night, so we won't worry about it. So like Catherine said, we're going to talk about the Hidden Museum Project, which is a research project that we undertook to understand how, you know, so mobile is a big thing in museums these days. You know, so we were, you know, everyone's coming in with a mobile device, everywhere you go, there's a mobile application that you can use. But, you know, it can be a bit controversial, mobile devices, because, you know, they are quite heads-down devices. I know anyone's ever been on the underground or on the train, everyone around you with their head down and their device, and that's not necessarily the kind of behaviour that you want in a museum setting. You want people looking up and looking at the objects and engaging with the things around them. So it was a research project to investigate how we could utilise mobile to get audiences to engage with the objects around them and, you know, see more rather than looking down into their device. So that's a research project that we're going to hear about over the next half an hour, so I won't go into more over that. I just wanted to say this project was made possible by something here at the university called the IT Innovation Fund. The university's carved out a chunk of funding from its capital budget to fund innovation projects. So, you know, they don't have to meet the same kind of strategic goals that we have to show that we meet with all of our other funding applications. We're allowed to do things a little bit more experimental, and in theory, we have permission to fail if things don't go well. So this was where we were able to get the money to undertake this project. And one interesting thing about the IT Innovation Fund is when you make an application, it actually goes onto an online portal where there's a community that can discuss projects and make comments and suggest people that you can talk to who might feed into your project. And that's actually how this project came together. There were two separate project applications, one from Scott and one from Ted. Of course, we already knew each other and worked together, but you know, they did come in separately. And, you know, looking at the projects through that portal, you could see how they aligned and came up with something even more interesting, which is the Hidden Museum Project, which we're going to start to hear about right now.
Yes, please.
Yes.
Okay.
Hello again.
My role on the Hidden Museum Project was to look at content, focus on content, and the idea behind this was born out of unlocking hidden stories. That's why it's called Hidden Museum. That's why there's a little key with a tag on it and a museum-like case in that photo there. And what we wanted to do is explore ways that we can deliver to people and unlock hidden stories, alternative viewpoints, connections, things that can't or aren't easily displayed in a physical space. And there's lots of reasons why you can't tell every story in space. Obviously, there's a limitation of what you can put on a label because of the size. There's a limitation on the size of your display case. There's a certain tone of voice that you might use in a museum display that you wouldn't necessarily want to deviate too far from with alternative voices. There is the possibility of telling the story about the history of the building as you stand in the middle of the space, but there'd be no physical location to present that. There's also alternative people's viewpoints as well. So there's lots of different ways that you can take an object or a room or a building and start to carve it up in different ways. So we recognise that mobile was one way that you might be able to deliver those kinds of alternative interpretations to visitors in the space. So we had this idea, but we didn't really at that point know exactly what people expected, what they wanted, what they had encountered previously. We didn't know what kinds of content would be suitable, and we didn't know what kind of format for that content would be most effective. So that's why this was a research project rather than just to build it and give it to people and have done with it. So through the research, we wanted to explore, firstly, what mobile could bring to a museum space and museum collections to unlock these stories, but also what people's expectations and behaviours were and sort of start to tease out how we might put together content in a package. And the ultimate, which Ted will talk about, the ultimate output for this was a prototype app which kind of drew on these all of these findings. But what I want to do now is sort of set the context for how we created that app and how we answered our own questions, if you like. we used in our research a combination of existing content, some things that we generated specially, and a combination of different types of technology triggering mechanisms to unlock that content in the spaces, which I'll talk through a little bit in a minute. If you could flick the slide to the next, next slide. To do this, we worked with an independent consultant. So we brought a consultant in to conduct a series of spot surveys, if you like, with visitors across three different museums. I don't know if you can read that, it's slightly small, but there were about 50 sessions altogether across the summer last year, working in the Ashmolean Museum, the Museum of Natural History, and the Museum of the History of Science. And in each of those locations, we used a different type or a combination of different types of content. So we'd use some audio content, some video content. We'd use some that was triggered manually. We'd use some that was triggered with a beacon, some that used a QR code. We'd use different lengths, different tones of voices. There's a whole combination of different types of content. And in each case, we would question people at the end. Our consultant would do an interview. They would try and tease out, well, what length felt correct? You know, what felt comfortable? When did people start getting twitchy and a bit bored? What triggering mechanisms were most intuitive or most seamless and least problematic? What tone of voice was right? So we had one set of videos that was very slightly off the wall interpretation of some of the material in the Ashmolean. Actually, it was a sort of what was it? Based on
Made in Chelsea.
So it was these reenactments of stories from was it Greek mythology in the style of Made in Chelsea. So that's quite a departure from what the Ashmolean Museum might normally do. Then, if you know Made in Chelsea, how comfortably did that sit with people? At the other end of the spectrum, we had audio content, which was much more traditional, the sort of straight narration of like an extended label, if you like, which we used in the Museum of History of Science. So by pulling all these things together, we were trying to create an ideal set of content that we could then package up and deliver to people in different ways. One of the things we found when we did this is that, and this is, you know, it's fairly obvious, but it's very important, as Jess said, that when you've got a mobile device in your hand, the tendency is for eyes to drop down, your head drops down, and you're on the screen. Now, that's an inevitable consequence of using mobile in the gallery, but we're very conscious that when people visit a museum, that they're visiting because of the materiality of the space. You go to a museum because it's got stuff in it. It's a physical space, and it's got all these things in it that you can sometimes touch or get very close to. And we don't want to detract from that any more than is absolutely necessary by putting a mobile in people's hands. So one of the things that came out very clearly in those tests was that when you deliver content via audio, which is the traditional way of doing it, people's heads are usually up. They tend to hold the device away from their faces, and they do this, and they look around, and they listen. As a great starting point, if you can deliver something via audio, you're going to get a better engagement with the objects around you. So that was one thing that came out very clearly. Video, on the other hand, necessarily draws attention away from the display or the object on the whole. So one of the things that we got back from responses of those surveys is people say, well, I like the video, but I only really like it when it offers me something that I can't get elsewhere. I can't get by reading the label, or I can't get by audio or by another means, which puts a higher threshold on when we might use video content. In other words, you had to really justify putting something on the screen in video, and I think that we tried to incorporate that in our prototype. The length of material proved to be very important as well. After about a minute, people start switching off and kind of, you know, twitching, and their focus dips away. And you could see that in body language. You could see it in just the attention they were paying to the content. So you've got to remember that this came across again when you're a lot with the interviews. When you're in a museum, you're visiting for a finite amount of time. You're on your feet. It's not particularly comfortable. You're probably not sitting down. You maybe, you know, have to go meet somebody for lunch, you're going somewhere later in the afternoon, whatever it is, you're not in an armchair watching a feature film. So content that you might put together for audio or video or whatever format for a museum visit is different from what you might do, for example, on YouTube, where you could be watching it on the bus when you've got half an hour, or you can be watching it at home, and it can be a longer, fuller thing to a point. So we had this sort of 60 second cut-off-ish. So we tried to keep everything quite short. The other thing we discovered is that it's very easy, when you're in museums and you know the displays and you know what you've written about and you're clear on, in our heads, what the content is about, it's actually very easy for the visitor to get confused between what they're listening to or watching and the exact thing on the display that they are supposed to be paying attention to. And that can be for a whole host of different reasons. Sometimes it's that in a case there's a whole range of, let's say, ceramic pots, and we think that we're talking about the one on the top right because we've shown a photograph of it two screens earlier, because they've just got a whole bunch of pots. And so you find people doing this and kind of looking around, and they don't know what it is exactly they're supposed to be looking at. The other thing is we would home in on a detail of an object in an attempt to get people to scrutinise it further, you know, to look again, to look closer. And if you don't make it explicitly clear where that detail is and where they should look and where they should position themselves physically, they lose the thread. So that was another thing that came out quite clearly. You know, to the point where you might say, go round the right-hand side of your case and bend down a little bit. Otherwise, you become unanchored from the thing that you're supposed to be focusing on. So that's a challenge. That's very difficult. It's very easy to explain that person to person. It's very hard to get that into a concise, succinct piece of digital content. And then the other thing I've written here is that there isn't any benefit to repackaging things that are already written about somewhere in the text on the display. Well, there is some benefit, actually, because a lot of people don't read labels, and they will say, I don't read any of that, you know, I just look at the stuff. So there is some benefit to packaging in audio. But on the whole, if you've got a little label, people will glance at that, and if the audio re-narrates that back to them, it feels slightly redundant, you know, like you haven't really delivered some extra benefit. And I think you really do need to deliver extra benefit when you're asking people to download these apps, hold them in their hands, listen to them, and so on. So to sum sort of all of that up at the bottom there, so everything that you we try to add to this prototype is adding value to that visit, is adding value to that moment in front of a particular object. It's not just packaging it up in a new way, hopefully. That's what we tend to see. Okay, yes, please. So after that, those research sessions in the summer with our consultant, she wrote a report and we sort of crunched all the findings, which I've summarised for you now. And we started to build a prototype app for the Museum of the History of Science specifically. So the initial phases, we'd worked across three different museums, three different types of material, different collections. And in the end, we realised it wasn't possible to build something for everywhere. So we focused on the Museum of the History of Science where I was working, which has, I don't know if you've been to it, it's in Broad Street, so just up in town, a really great collection of scientific instruments. Obscure, slightly esoteric things that unless you are a science historian or you particularly know about mathematical instruments or astronomy are quite inscrutable, actually. They're beautiful and they're intricate, but you don't necessarily know what they are. So it's kind of a challenging collection to work with anyway. But that's good because that was the point of this project, really, is to unlock these stories. So bearing in mind everything I've just said, what I started to think about is, well, what really adds value to people's visits when they come to the museum now? So forget digital, forget mobile. What is it that I see when people come into the museum happening where you can tell they've had a better time, you can tell they've got something extra out of it? And it came fairly clear very quickly that the best experience is when you've got the curator or a member of staff, but we'll say the curator for short, next to you, telling you things, telling you stories, pointing at stuff, making a little joke maybe, telling you an anecdotal bit of interpretation about an object which is not something that would ever quite make its way onto the label, but is interesting or funny or just surprising. Pointing at details, saying, yeah, if you look at this, come around here, look at that. That sort of thing, that guiding hand of someone who's knowledgeable, who can present well, and so on. So I thought, well, that's what we need to capture, or as much of that as we can, in a digital form, which is not easy. So that's where the title, the pocket curator, came from, the idea that you have the curator in your pocket. And what we were trying to do here, as I've written, is just the way a curator or somebody giving a tour or something giving a one-to-one walk through the museum would do, you're trying to bridge the what I've used the phrase interpretive gaps. But what I mean by that is, where are the gaps that it's very hard for a non-specialist visitor to jump over to understand something better? And that might be poor labelling, or it might be not looking in the right place, or it might be lack of prior knowledge, or whatever, or something written in a voice that just isn't captivating, you know, isn't engaging. All those things can create a gap between understanding something and appreciating it more. So that's what we're trying to do. So then the next question is, how can mobile help us to do that? So I think this is maybe another slide. So I'm going to give you an example from the MHS History of Science collection. So there's an object in the basement gallery of the MHS called the Westmoreland Lodestone. And that is a photograph of it. Right? Imagine, well, does anyone know what a lodestone is, for a start, just out of interest? Anyone want to venture? Okay, so we've immediately fallen the first hurdle. Westmoreland doesn't really mean anything. It's a place. Lodestone, not sure, sounds familiar. But then you look at the object itself and it's completely inscrutable. It's a big wooden glass cabinet with a crown in the middle of it. And there's a little label here, but it doesn't really tell you a great deal. And there's some sort of structure in the middle holding the crown up, but it's a ratchet. So it's a very bizarre thing. And so people ask about it all the time. The labelling doesn't explain it very well. I've written here it's the second most asked about object in the MHS. I think the first most asked about object is Einstein's blackboard, which I think Ted's going to mention in a while. So what is it? How does it work? How do you use it? All of these kinds of questions. Some of those can be answered through someone just explaining something, giving a bit of history, a bit of context. Some of them need to be demonstrated because it's a mechanical device. I'll just very briefly tell you what it is. A lodestone is a naturally magnetic mineral, magnetite, and it was this whole cabinet was built for a duke who used it to demonstrate the magnetic properties at the Royal Society. And what happens is that the magnet is inside the crown, under the crown, and a big hook is magnetically held onto the crown, and then onto the hook are weights added one by one until the weight on the hook is greater than the natural magnet can hold, and the whole thing crashes down onto a big spring. So it's basically a demonstration model instrument to show the power of this natural magnet. So it's quite a grand thing, as I say, it's used at the Royal Society. So that's what we had to try and convey. And Ted may talk a little bit more about that later. So how do we do that? Well, at this point, when we're building the prototype, we want to bear in mind this idea of heads up, only use certain kinds of material if it adds value and is justified, and think about what particular aspects of your story or your interpretation lend themselves to different kinds of digital content. So that's the structure of the Pocket Curator. Our guiding principle then is that if you can tell something with a piece of audio, do so, because if you're using audio, as I said, people are looking at the object and they are engaging with it, and you can direct them to look at certain things specifically in the audio as well, and their hands are free to do so. Audio is dead easy, really. We got one of the curators to speak. We scripted it and recorded it, so it's slightly presented by someone who works in the museum. And each piece has three little audio recordings. What that means is you can tell three quite different stories. Again, you couldn't do that in a label. It would be too big. It would be too... it would jump around too much, too disparate in a way. But these are three different strands of story, so that's quite nice. But then, where the audio can't take you far enough, because the thing is too complex to explain in words, we have built interactive or animated pieces of video. So in this particular case, it's an interactive. Are you going to talk about the lodestone? So Ted will talk about that. That shows how it worked, so you can actually have a go, which is in this case is the best way to understand the mechanism. I think that's... I'll leave it there because I think Ted's going to talk through things. But I just want to give you an example of the types of things that you can do, particularly in the audio, that you would never probably do in a museum label. So Stephen, who's the curator of the museum, was talking. We were talking through recording the audio pieces. And as it happened, one of the objects is a moon globe called Selenographia. It's a globe of the moon, and it's made with this beautiful moon and a tiny little Earth next to it, and which is curious because obviously the moon is smaller than the Earth. And Stephen had just a week or two before been researching this object and discovered there's a little brass plate between the moon and the Earth. And the reason the Earth is so tiny is because the maker of the model was trying to represent the Earth at the size it would appear if you were at the centre of the moon. So that was the representation. But if he did that, the Earth would get so small that you wouldn't be able to put any features on it. You wouldn't be able to recognise it as the Earth. So he made it a bit too big. So, and Stephen has just sort of found this out. Has he made a mistake? Obviously not. And he found that there's this little brass plate between the Earth and the moon. And the brass plate was even smaller than the Earth model. And it was the brass plate that represented the size of the Earth as seen from the centre of the moon. So that was only just discovered. It wasn't on the label. It was a really nice thing to add in. And it requires a bit of explanation. If you've read that down in words, it'd be a bit wordy. And another example, there's another object from revolutionary France, which is a clock which has a 10-hour day on it, created by a master clockmaker called Henri Janvier. But there was a little aside that Stephen told me. He said, well, this is a curious irony of history, is that Henri Janvier sat on the committee, French Revolutionary Committee for the Reform of Time. Wonderful collective hubris there. And whilst on that committee, he was one of the people who abolished the month of January, so he abolished his own name, Janvier. That's a lovely little odd story. Again, you wouldn't put that in, but we've managed to sneak that in as a piece of audio, which enriches that object, I think. So that's the kind of thing that we're able to do. But I'm going to let Ted talk you through now how the interactive components of Pocket Curator work.
Sure. First of all, is it going to be a problem if I stay over here? Because I've got I'm tethered to the laptop, unfortunately.
That's right.
That's going to be all right? OK, so I get to do the absolutely terrifying part of the presentation. So, wish me luck. So, this is Pocket Curator. I am tethered to the laptop, so what you're seeing there is what's on my phone. Hopefully you're also going to hear the audio. Make sure that's loud enough. Okay, so we start out with the three galleries of the Museum of History and Science. It's got an upper gallery, a miniature gallery, and a basement gallery. I'm going to navigate down to the basement gallery, and I see we've got three objects there, and they're located on a map. The object I'm going to show you first is the one that that Scott had just introduced. And now, so pretend Scott wasn't there to tell you everything, and we're going to take a look at nature's magnet, right? And so as you saw on the slide, we've got an image of the object, so you know what you're looking at, or that you're looking at the right thing at least. You can, if you're not in front of it, you can find it on the floor plan. We've got the three bits of audio. I'm going to play one for you right now.
What is a lodestone? A lodestone is a piece of the naturally magnetic mineral called magnetite. In this grand-looking object, the actual lodestone is difficult to see, as it's hidden inside the crown in the centre. If you bend down and look up towards the bottom of the crown, the dark circular area is the lodestone.
Okay, I'm going to stop that there, but it goes on for maybe another 7 seconds or so. An important thing happened there, right? He said if you bend down and look up. So again, here's one of these cases where we're trying to get people to engage with the object. Now, so you can listen to the audio, but then you can also, as Scott mentioned, have a go with the lodestone. And so it gives you a quick introductory screen, you hit start, and then gives you a few instructions. So if I tap on the keys to begin, right, they animate up there, and I can start winding them. And we can start adding some weights. And of course it dropped. Now one thing that you couldn't experience there by just looking at it there is the phone also vibrates in your hand when it goes ka-chunk. So you get this sort of feel like that. So that's great. I think it's great. But it still sort of heads down, isn't it? Because, you know, you're doing something on your phone, you know, you're not interacting with the object itself. And, you know, we've been emphasizing this quite a bit, but, you know, audio is great, and it makes you heads up, but it's also technology from the 80s, right? We've moved a long way from the 80s, right? And, you know, we all had Walkmans and Michael Jackson tape. And so now we thought, well, we've got all this technology, let's see what we can do with it. Making what we do with it inherent from the content itself. We're not trying to do things just because we can. We want to make sure what we do derives from the thing that we're trying to talk about. So, another live demo. The next object I'm going to show you, if everything works correctly, is this object here. Does anyone know what this is? There was a clue earlier in the presentation. Einstein's blackboard. So it's one of the key exhibits in the museum. Lots of people want to see it. That's Einstein's writing. They saved the blackboard. Apparently there were two. One of them got lost to the vagaries of time. Hello? So does anyone know what it means? Well, fortunately, we're a university with a physics department, but have clever people that do know what it means. And yeah, puts one of them in your pocket. So if we click on Einstein's blackboard, you see something similar. You have some small bits of story about it. And then you can click here or tap here on what does it all mean. Then you can point it. Let me just keep that way. Point it at the blackboard. You put it down and point it at the blackboard. There it goes. And you get...
So this lecture was given by Einstein when he just heard news that the universe is expanding. Edwin Hubble had recently showed results that showed that galaxies distant from our own appear to move away from us. He was one of the most preeminent scientists of the time, showing how, with new data, new observations of space, he could put together a possible model of how the universe could have begun, how it could be growing, and how it could end. So the first equation tells us about the expansion rate of the universe. And it includes the speed of light and the distance to an
object. This goes on for about 3 minutes. So it's one of the...
And the speed at which that object...
It's one of the cases where we sort of broke the 1 minute rule because it is actually quite complicated. But having an Oxford professor, this is Professor Joe Dunkley of the physics department, doing the lecture for you, you can't really do it under 3 minutes. In fact, she was quite fast to try to do it.
She was curt as well.
and to make it comprehensible. But it was important to us to have the entire lecture there because she sits there, she stands there, and she does everything on the board. So that's one of the ways that we've enhanced Einstein's blackboard. Play another. Can you guess the object? Does anyone know what this is?
Minus one.
Sorry?
Minus one.
Nope, it's not a wireless wonder. In fact, it's not on the screen at all. So, yeah. I purposely didn't navigate to the screen.
It's an astrolabe.
It's a sextant. Yes, does anyone know how a sextant works? Right. I doubt very many people do. So, you're on a ship. Go ahead. Yes, yes.
The size of the longitude. I don't
yeah, it's for determining latitude when you're at sea. Exactly. So you're on a ship at sea, right? And you know you're doing this, right? And you've got the sextant. It's got a scope on it, and you look through the scope. Again, you're at sea. This is why pirates have eye patches. And you line it up with the horizon through the scope. You move an arm on it that moves a mirror inside until you can see the sun line up with the horizon. You take the angle on that, and you use an almanac to determine your latitude, right? Quite complicated concept to get across to people. So what we thought is, well, we have this device here that has a scope-like thing, it's a camera, and that knows how you're holding it. It's a bit like moving the arm, isn't it? So what we thought we'd do is give you an opportunity to calculate your latitude with the sextant. And we're going to start.
Everybody's there.
I'm lining up the horizon, so I'll set the horizon there. Oops, I was a little bit off, so our calculation would be a little bit off. But now I'm going to look for the sun. And we had to do this at the highest point the sun can possibly be in the year.
Today.
There's, well, it's not necessarily today, but close enough. Animation shows you how what you did relates to how the sextant works, and then it tells you the angle you did. And of course, it's a bit complicated because you have to check an almanac. So you kind of press a button to check the almanac. It tells you the date, the time, roughly noonday, the angle of the sun, and the latitude. As you can see there, we do a live calculation on the angle that you measured to give you the latitude for that day, for the day that you are in. For the correct date, and you can see that we ended up, even if I was a little bit off on the horizon, pretty much at Oxford. And so that's the sextant. I always want to do this, I always want to click the button up there, but it's not the right one. And so we're going to play one last guess the object, and that's this. This is a real gold star if anyone picks this up. Okay, this is a box with a bell on it. This box is a very special box with a bell on it because at the turn of last century, a guy named something
Guillermo.
Thank you, Marconi, would demonstrate wireless communication with it. Take the box with the bell, he'd put it in one corner of the room, and then he would stand in the other corner with a spark gap generator, he'd make a spark, and the bell would ring. And this was amazing at the time, this was like magic. All right, so, again, we figured, we have this phone, and it kind of does wireless communication. Sorry, I'm having orientation issues. Let me just do that. And we have our wireless wonder. So we have a phone that does wireless for you. So we thought we'd do an interactive that replicates this experiment. So again, we also thought it was important that they were looking at the object. So we're using image recognition for that to sort of orient them to the box. So you can see there's a little outline on the box. I'm going to move this in front of me. So in the gallery, of course, you point it at the box. It recognizes it. And then you get an actual bell in the gallery. So that's a box there that we've built that has a little speaker on it. Ring Bluetooth transmission makes the bell ring. I'm going to try that again. So that's going to be installed in the gallery right above the box, so it actually feels like it's coming from the display itself. So
120 years ago, you've been really impressed with that.
And now you're like, you know, I can control my house from here. You know? But anyway, it's still, I think, in the museum, you know, when you're surrounded by ancient technology in the museum, having that happen there live is still a bit of a surprise and still a bit of a...
Also, you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So you can transmit. Right, so from there, that's all well and good, but, you know, it's a lot of work. And, you know, why would you spend so much time making these things if audio is, you know, maybe arguably just as good? Well, you know, audio and video, they're for visual and auditory learners, but there are learners out there that learn best by doing things, learn best by moving their body. So that's one reason. The other is that they allow people to get behind the glass. And both of those played out in the feedback that we got from people when we were doing testing, right? So you can interact with, when you're interacting with the object itself, you feel a bit closer to it, and it gives you a bit more of an understanding of how it worked. So one thing you notice, I described how sextant worked, but when you actually try to do it, you get much more of a full understanding of what it is. And indeed, one of our testers was saying, well, I had no interest in these objects, these navigation objects before, this area, but now I'm really intrigued. You know, when I actually got a chance to try it, you could have told me all about it, you could have given me a video about it, but trying it is what kind of hooked me on thinking, oh wow, this is much different from what I thought, it's actually quite interesting. And then, you know, I have to say it, but it is fun and memorable, and those are good things in and of themselves. So if you can give somebody a fun and memorable experience of something, of an engagement with a museum object, with some educational content, that goes a long way for having them retain it later. And indeed, you know, this has helped us a lot when we've done this presentation to a lot of decision makers around the university, right? And the parts of the demonstration they remember are the interactive bits. right? And it's also, you know, one of those demonstrations, as Scott said, this was meant to just be a prototype, but it's a pretty finished product now. And that was because we were able to get a bit of extra funding having done the demonstration. So strategically, internally, it has a purpose as well. You know, it shows what you can do, and it kind of moves the field forward a bit. So that's all I have for the demonstration. I'm going to hand it back over to Jess, I think, for the wrap-up.
Yeah, well, I just want to tie it up by thinking about, you know, what next for us, because, you know, it was a research project. It's great that we're going to have an app that we're going to launch very soon, both iOS and Android. That's important. About half our visitors are about 50-50 iOS and Android. So that is really great, but I know that we're looking at ways we can apply the things we've learned from the research project more broadly across what we do across all of the museums. Say what you will about audio being a little bit antiquated. In fact, I think the first audio guide is from late in the 19th century, so that is how antiquated it is. But, I mean, our research showed that it is really effective, so I've already saved loads of money on convincing people not to make video. Great. And applying those lessons about length and about tone as we, you know, work to create new audio has been really valuable. And we've actually recently procured money for, again, from the IT Innovation Fund to look at how we deliver audio content and making that process a lot easier with an intuitive content management system, which, you know, Ted is working on as well. So hopefully, you know, it'll be relatively easy to apply those lessons that we learned around audio broader across all of the museums. It's much more complicated with the interactives because they do all have to be bespoke, and we only did 7 objects from the Museum of the History of Science. That was a lot of work for 7 objects. I don't know if you've been to the Ashmolean or the Museum of Natural History or the Pitt Rivers, you know, there's a lot of objects in there. So it is very intensive, and, you know, finding the right kind of funding and funders who are interested in funding this kind of really in-depth work is, you know, the next challenge for us in order to be able to apply these lessons. But actually, the big challenge is getting people to, I mean, everyone who we tested this app with have really enjoyed it and found it really engaging and said it really enhanced their experience. Though now the challenge is getting people to download the app. I mean, only about 5% of our visitors actually log onto our public Wi-Fi, so that's a very low number. And when you speak to visitors, a lot of them say they may be reluctant to download an app because it takes up space on their phone and they don't know if they're going to want to use it. So the next challenge for us is really a communications challenge about explaining to people that this is available and how it's going to enhance their visit and that they should do it.
There was one thing I didn't mention in sort of the benefits for doing the interactives is that it can sell the app in the gallery a bit. So if you're seeing somebody interacting with a phone ringing bell in the lower gallery, you see somebody doing a sextant, so you've got that sort of, they're advertising the app for you as well, so we're hoping that drives it as well.
Yeah, and I suppose that'll be our kind of next research, because, you know, we interview our visitors a lot and they tell us a lot of things, which then when you observe their behavior turns out to be entirely untrue, not on purpose, people are just really bad at reporting on their own behavior. So once the app's actually launched, that'll be a great opportunity for us to see, you know, how we can overcome some of those hurdles about people actually engaging with it and therefore really successfully enhancing their experience. That's all.